the gentlewoman from California would please raise her right hand, which you're doing. Do you solemnly swear that you will support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, that you will bear true faith and allegiance to the same, that you take this obligation freely without any mental reservation or purpose of evasion, and that you will well and faithfully discharge the duties of the office on which you're about to enter, so help you God.
I do.
Congratulations, Madam Speaker.
Nancy Pelosi sworn in as Speaker of the House again. It's the official beginning of the 116th Congress and of Democratic House control. It is the most diverse House ever. A record number of women were sworn in today, more than 100. So what's ahead for the Democrats, for Congress, for the White House, for Washington? To discuss this, we have Molly Ball, national political correspondent at Time Magazine. Welcome back, Molly.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. And Ella Nilsson's here. She covers Congress for Vox. Welcome to you.
Thank you so much.
Molly, let's begin with you. You profiled Nancy Pelosi a few months ago, spent some time with her on the campaign trail. This was before the midterms. Do you think she deserves credit or partially credit for the results we're seeing today?
That's an interesting question. My take on Pelosi in my profile and the time I spent with her was that her main skill set was doing the job of Speaker of the House, doing legislation, running the House. There's really no one in Washington or anywhere else, I guess, who holds a candle to her when it comes to that kind of thing. Her political skills are a little bit more questionable. She's won elections, she's lost elections. She personally has only ever won elections in her district, and she hasn't actually had a tough election since she was first elected in a 14-way Democratic primary in 1987. But in the elections that she's been a part of, in terms of steering the Democratic message, she obviously lost the speakership in 2010 after a disastrous rebuke to President Obama and the Democratic Congress in Washington, and Democrats failed to retake the House in 2012 and 2014. So the fact that they won this year, the one thing I think you can say about Nancy Pelosi's role in this election is that she was at the center of it. Mm-hmm. It was an election that centered around Trump in many ways, but Republicans and Democrats alike also put Nancy Pelosi at the center of it. You had a huge proportion of Republican ads messaging on the idea of Nancy Pelosi as a sort of boogeyman, or maybe you have to say boogeywoman, because she is so polarizing and unpopular with the public at large. The idea being, however much you may like your local Democratic candidate for Congress, a vote for that person is a vote to put Nancy Pelosi back in the Speaker's chair, and we can't do that because she represents everything we dislike about liberal values and the Democratic Party. And Democrats, too. She's a prodigious fundraiser. That's another one of her skill sets. Has raised hundreds of millions of dollars for Democratic candidates over the course of her career, and that is also part of her legislative strategy, because then the Democrats who've made it to Congress, many of them have been dependent on her largesse and may thus owe her favors either implicitly or explicitly.
Mm. Interesting. Okay, well, Ella, let's talk about the wing of the Democratic Party the left side of the Democratic Party, let's say, that is having maybe some issues with her and her as a leader. And in fact, I think that she has promised to just be a leader until 2022. So we'll see about that. But let's talk about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. She is now promoting this Green New Deal, and she was part of a sit-in of Pelosi's office a short while ago. Can you talk about that and what that signals for the road ahead for the Democrats?
Sure. Well, I'd just like to point out, first of all, that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez today voted for Pelosi, and there wasn't a lot of question that she was going to do that. And much of the opposition to Pelosi's speakership hasn't so much come from the left wing of the party as much as some of the more moderate Democrats that flipped some conservative districts and pledged to vote against Pelosi. A number of those did so today. But as far as sort of the left wing versus a more establishment fights that we're looking at going ahead. Ocasio-Cortez yesterday came out publicly against Democrats' rules package, which is sort of the first thing that they do after they elect a new speaker. And that was an objection over something known as PAYGO, which has to do with needing to make sure that any major piece of legislation is fully paid for, whether that's by cutting spending or increasing taxes. So there is already a little bit of tension in terms of that. As far as the Green New Deal goes, that is something else that might sort of become a little bit more contentious as we go on. Nancy Pelosi has announced a select committee to address climate change. It's not exactly the same thing that Ocasio-Cortez is asking for, which is a select committee specifically to talk about the Green New Deal, which is a proposal that she has put forward, this kind of wide-ranging proposal to aggressively tackle climate change, has some pretty, some deadlines that are kind of coming right up, in 10 years, cutting emissions by quite a bit. But I would say that, there is some signs that Pelosi is certainly trying to work with the left on a number of issues. So while there have been a few fights popping up here and there, I would say that it's not, certainly not an all-out brawl yet.
Yeah. And so she did agree to that the House will have hold hearings on Medicare for All.
Yeah.
And that signals a pretty big change, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, certainly progressive leaders are touting that as a big early win. The fact that Pelosi and committee chairs have agreed to hold hearings on Medicare for All, that's a huge win for progressives. I mean, it's not Pelosi explicitly backing the idea, certainly, but it's her giving her blessing and committee chairs saying to go ahead and at least let's talk about this idea in the public sphere. Let's hold committee hearings on it. Let's have the American people, learn more about this in a very kind of, official way. That is kind of giving the idea a big platform in committee meetings and a potential path forward, which is a huge win for progressives.
And Molly, let's talk about the three committees that a lot of Democrats are focusing on when it comes to Donald Trump and the investigations surrounding him. That's Judiciary, Intelligence and Oversight, Jerry Nadler, Adam Schiff and Elijah Cummings heading those committees. What do we expect? Do we just expect for the next 2 years or so investigation after investigation after investigation into Donald Trump, his family, his business, et cetera?
Well, yes and no. I think Democrats firmly believe that they won this election because they tried as best they could to ignore the constant Trump maelstrom and talk only about policy. They felt they had to convince the American people that they had an agenda that was substantive, that was positive, that they stood for something that wasn't just opposition to Trump. And I think because the Trump news cycle is so all-enveloping, they had to do that in order to break through at all with the things they wanted to talk about, particularly health care and the economy. The irony of that is going to be, of course, that they can't get any of that done because we have a divided Congress and a divided Washington. Pelosi spoke about bipartisanship on election night when the Democrats took the House, and she spoke about bipartisanship again today in accepting the gavel. But there has been precious little bipartisanship in Washington for many years. Not a lot of reason to think that could change, despite some areas of hypothetical agreement, such as prescription drug pricing reform and infrastructure, and what just passed on criminal justice reform. There just aren't a lot of warm feelings across the aisle. But the thing that Democrats can do with control of only one House of Congress is subpoena and investigate the president and his administration. And so the irony is going to be that although the message they'd like to put forward is legislation, they can't really do legislation. They can do investigations. And so what's going to produce the most results out of this Democratic Congress is going to be that they can haul, the attorney general, the former secretary of the interior, all kinds of potential witnesses and documents they can bring before the committees and make public and hold hearings and try to create some accountability for what many Democrats consider a lawless administration.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of relationship does Nancy Pelosi have with Mitch McConnell?
With McConnell, she has, I think, a professional relationship with Trump. She has a very interesting relationship, I think. They have there's this sort of odd respect and sort almost solicitousness that he seems to have for her. Although he's made fun of her in public, he does this sort of obligatory, I guess, for a Republican trashing of her when he's in front of Republican crowds. He hasn't given her a notable nickname, and in her presence, he's rather polite. There was that interesting tableau when he called the cameras in to that mm-hmm. meeting that he had with Pelosi and Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer a couple of weeks ago, and even there where she was publicly contradicting him and standing up to him and he was sort of sulking about it, you didn't see them screaming at each other. And there is a sense that they may be able to work together. One of the really remarkable things, I think, about the last couple of years is that even with Trump in the presidency and Republicans in control of both houses of Congress, Nancy Pelosi has racked up a lot of wins for the Democrats. The government's shut down right now, but up to now, the government has largely been kept open, and the government has been funded, and a lot of Democratic priorities have gotten funded at levels that Republicans didn't like but had to accept simply because Pelosi was such a good negotiator.
All right. There's the music. That means one thing. The end of our conversation. Molly Ball, national political correspondent at Time Magazine. Ella Nilsson, congressional reporter for Vox. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Among the Democrats who made Nancy Pelosi speaker were the seven newest members of the California delegation. KCRW's Michelle Aloy is in Washington, where she's been following two of those new members, the Katies, Katie Hill and Katie Porter. She joins us now from the Capitol. Hi.
Hi, Madeline.
All right. So pretty exciting there for the Katies, I imagine. But let's stick with the politics for the time being. We talked about the fact that all of the new California representatives voted yes for Pelosi as speaker. And we've been talking about this divide in the party. And Pelosi does have her work cut out for her when it comes to unifying the left and the right wings of this party. Where do both Katie Hill and Katie Porter fit in with all of that?
So both Porter and Hill have been saying, you know, for a while that they were going to be voting for Pelosi. And that's despite the fact that they come from kind of different wings of the party. Katie Porter has said that she's going to join the Progressive Caucus. She's seen as a sort of an acolyte of Elizabeth Warren. She was one of her students. Whereas Katie Hill is more in the middle. She will also be joining the Progressive Caucus. But she's also going to be part of a moderate group of lawmakers from swing districts called the New Democrats. But both of them, in interviews that I did earlier with them, you know, they pointed to Pelosi's leadership skills, her ability to keep the party together as reasons why they planned to cast their vote for her, which is, you know, exactly what they did today. As for the other lawmakers, it was sort of interesting to watch as the votes unfolded. I think like one of your earlier guests said, you know, there wasn't really any doubt that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez from New York wasn't going to be voting for Pelosi. But when she did, there was some sort of snickers and hand claps to be heard in the gallery.
Okay, that's funny. So all of this is taking place amidst this partial government shutdown, as we've been reporting. How have these two lawmakers positioned themselves on that issue?
So both are supporting the House bills to reopen the government. Right now, they seem to be going along with the leadership's plans to push back against Trump, try to make this about him when it comes to the shutdown. You know, that said, it's not likely to go very far. President Trump has already rejected that idea. He did so on Wednesday. And Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, has said that he's not going to put anything up for a vote that doesn't have the president's support. So these bills are likely to be mostly ceremonial, but they are going to be, you know, it's part of the message that Democrats are looking to push as they take the majority, which is this message of good governance. They think that's going to keep them in the public graces as we start looking to 2020.
Okay, so you spent the morning with Katie Hill as she was getting ready to be sworn in, and tell us what her day's been like.
That's right. It was really exciting. I mean, a lot has been made of the fact that there are a lot of women coming in. This is the most women who've ever been in Congress. And you saw lots of high fives and hugs. And there was a real sense of camaraderie here. As for Katie Hill, the day started around 9:30 for her. I met her outside of her new office building just hours before she was sworn in. The federal government may be partially shut down, but you wouldn't know it by the lines of people snaking along the steps of the legislative office buildings on this cool, cloudy morning in D.C. Representative-elect Katie Hill climbs out of a big black Chevy SUV.
Morning.
Good morning.
As Hill walks up the steps to her new office, those same people waiting in line shout congratulations to her and other words of encouragement. Hill's new office, located just across the street from the Capitol, is buzzing as her mostly female staff gets ready for the big day. But first, Hill has a personal problem she needs to deal with.
They delivered my mattress to my home in California for the second time.
That's right, Hill still doesn't have a bed to sleep on in her new apartment. Amazon keeps delivering her order to her home in Agua Dulce.
So they just left the other package next to the one that was still there. So there's two.
So while members from Hill's team tended to office visitors from various interest groups and other campaigns, Hill called Amazon. Yes, even soon-to-be members of Congress get put on hold.
I don't know what else I'd be doing right now. Probably just bothering my team, so, you know. Amazon, you've never failed me before.
With that resolved, it's time for Hill to walk over to the Capitol to get her member pin, her voting card, and her parking pass. Once outside, Hill is greeted by her parents and friends, and more shouts of congratulations from passersby. Hill's mom, Stephanie, gives her a new string of pearls, which complement the sleek indigo two-piece sheath dress she's wearing. But her mom didn't even have time to take the price tag off beforehand.
I thought we were going to have a moment.
It's never a moment.
Yeah, we're going to have to do this there.
Perfect.
Yeah, I need okay.
All right.
Good luck. Thanks,
guys.
Bye.
Well, we're almost
there. Oh, you're almost there. Sorry.
We're following you.
Following me.
As soon as Hill crosses Independence Avenue to make her way into the Capitol building, she's in work mode. Hill is immediately surrounded by cameras and reporters who want to ask her about impeaching President Trump, the shutdown, and the wall.
How do you think you're going to manage to deal with the president? He's very stuck on his number of, you know, 5 million for the wall. What's going to happen? How are you going to come to the middle?
I mean, at the end of the day, he doesn't have any leverage. I mean, people's livelihoods are at stake. We have made it very clear. We're not doing anything extreme. We're doing something that the Republican Senate and that he had agreed to previously. We're going to pass something that they absolutely should sign. We'll come back to the table with the DHS funding, the Homeland Security funding. But this is something that he's just being ridiculous about.
After a few questions, Hill and her family and some of her staffers make their way through security. They snake their way through the ornate golden halls of the Capitol building, with Hill not entirely sure where she's going.
Yeah, Katie, can you just tell me kind of what we're doing here?
I don't even know what we're doing right now. I think we're going to get my pin and my voting card, apparently.
Pin and voting card in hand, Hill heads into the House chamber for her first roll call and then to cast her vote for the next Speaker of the House.
Hill of California.
For the future generations of women who will lead this country, Nancy Pelosi.
Pelosi.
Then it was Hill's moment, along with the more than 100 other new House freshman lawmakers.
Will you all please raise your right hand? Do you solemnly swear that you will support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, that you will bear true faith and allegiance to the same, that you take this obligation freely without any mental reservation or purpose of evasion, and that you will well and faithfully discharge the duties of the office on which you are about to enter, so help you God. Congratulations, you are now.
Now that Hill is an official member of Congress, the highs of winning her election and getting ready to come to D.C. could come to an abrupt end. She and her colleagues now have to navigate the politics of a government shutdown with no end in sight. And they're the beginning of a new era of government that's arguably more divided and more partisan than ever before.
That's Press Play producer Michelle Aloy in Washington. Be sure to look out for her reporting throughout the rest of the week as she follows Katie Hill and Katie Porter during their first week as lawmakers. Coming up, the limits of empathy for the homeless. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled.
This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. How do you feel when you see a homeless person or a homeless encampment? Well, how you answer matters a lot. That's because public empathy has gone a long way toward funding new housing programs. And yet, despite all the money now being funneled into new construction and services for the homeless, it doesn't seem like the problem is being solved. There are still 50,000 people living on the streets in Los Angeles. KCRW's Anna Scott reports now on the increasing impatience Angelenos feel for what's become a very public problem.
For the past few years, a man has been living in the carport at Shannon Peace's building near West Hollywood.
I would pull in and he'd be laying like right there, and those are the lockers.
For a while, he had a pretty elaborate setup.
He had a laptop, he had a bicycle, and he used our storage bins. We have storage bins above our cars, and he used them.
She was a little uncomfortable at first, but eventually thought of him as an unofficial neighbor. Until one morning, she came downstairs.
And his eyes were glazed over and he was muttering to himself. And that was the point at which I went, okay, this is somebody who potentially has mental illness, potentially has a substance abuse problem.
She called the cops, but the man still sleeps in front of Peace's car on and off. She says the experience has made her more wary of homeless people in general.
And it's not that I don't have empathy anymore, but when it comes to your own feelings of safety, need for boundaries, suddenly it influences the way you view the entire issue. And unfortunately, it can influence the way you view individuals.
Of course, it's impossible to take the emotional temperature of an entire city. But in recent months, I've had dozens of conversations like this with people impatient over a situation that, on a personal level, hasn't improved much. 2 years ago, LA voters overwhelmingly passed Measure HHH, a city bond to fund homeless housing, which it's doing, but tens of thousands of men and women still sleep on the streets, which means residents confront the crisis constantly. Shannon Peace says she would still vote for something like HHH, but next time she would want a specific timeline for seeing the results.
Okay, are you telling me by 2020? Are we saying by 2025? I'm all for services. I'm really hoping there is a way that we can help people. Selfishly, I would prefer somebody not to be in my carport.
There's definitely a growing tension and people frustrated by the challenges that we're facing here in this city.
LA City Councilwoman Monica Rodriguez. She recently asked the state to extend hate crime protections to people experiencing homelessness. She made the proposal after a few violent incidents where people sleeping outside were targeted. Those are rare cases, but Rodriguez worries about anger towards the homeless in general, because things like new shelters, which the city is trying to build more than a dozen of, require the public's support.
We have a solution. It just requires them to have the compassion and the empathy to work with us to help address this problem.
And most people do, according to one poll. The United Way of Greater Los Angeles surveyed 1,000 likely voters early last year and found almost 70% of them would support new homeless housing in their neighborhoods. Yet, over the past year, in some parts of the region, anger over encampments and a potentially dangerous element in them has led to explosive town halls, hateful social media posts, and even one citizen patrol to monitor encampments. Other times, there's a quieter but still uneasy coexistence, like at this park in West L.A.
I haven't traveled in about a month, so I don't feel good.
Felipe Calderon is one of about a half dozen homeless men here today, and he's spread his belongings across a picnic table. He used to have a carpentry business, but he lost it to drinking.
Once you lose a job, you lose everything, your wife, even the kids.
He still drinks, but wants to stop.
I'm going to try this year, you know. This is one of my goals. If I stop, I'm going to get back on my feet again.
It's easy to feel for the financial victim or the person who ended up homeless after a health crisis. Harder to feel for someone you think is doing something wrong, like the guy hiding a beer cooler near a busy playground, especially if that's all you know about him.
That isn't the entire story of that person.
Anne English knows that stories like Calderon's are generally long, complicated, and messy. She works at the nonprofit Corporation for Supportive Housing. She directs a program training formerly homeless men and women to share their stories at community events. Hearing individual experiences, she says, can help people recognize the mental sorting they sometimes do, often without realizing it, between who is worthy of empathy and who is not.
How can one person be deserving and another person? I mean, it's just, I feel like in order for us to move forward, it really is about being willing to ask some deeper questions and not just kind of make so many assumptions.
She says it's about getting the public to see people who need help rather than people to avoid.
If they recognize someone who is having difficulties as someone that could be them, they are going to connect with that. And that is what moves people to action.
What's frustrating for many in Los Angeles is that they took action back in 2016 when they passed Measure HHH. They passed a second countywide measure in 2017, too, to fund homeless services.
Because a very complex problem didn't go away overnight doesn't mean that things aren't happening.
LA Mayor Eric Garcetti says the city is housing more people than ever before, but it's not enough to keep up with all the people falling into homelessness. So the situation on the streets hasn't changed much. Still, Garcetti says he does not see an empathy gap among LA residents.
Every time I go to a volunteer event, there's more and more people. They still need a lot of help in their neighborhoods, but they're feeling that what they voted for is starting to come to fruition.
But what do you say to the people who say, okay, I voted for Measure HHH, but I thought that I would see a noticeable difference in my neighborhood faster, and now I'm frustrated?
I would say I'm one of those people too.
Garcetti says people should stay frustrated. Impatience, he says, will lead to solutions faster than apathy. For KCRW, I'm Anna Scott.
Coming up, a new study on museums finds that they're buying works mainly from the same old pool of artists.
African American artists may have been increasing, Latinx and Asian artists were declining. In that sense, I thought it was really important to say that you can't start sacrificing one for the other, and this shouldn't be a kind of competition.
A push to make museums and art galleries more diverse, next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. You've probably seen Amy Sherald's portrait of Michelle Obama. The former first lady is wearing a big flowy dress, her chin resting on her hand, the backdrop in baby blue. Then there's Kehinde Wiley's painting of Barack Obama in a suit, sitting in a chair, green leaves all around him. Another African-American artist, Kerry James Marshall, recently toured the country with a retrospective of his paintings. It was a blockbuster show. So African-American artists are becoming more visible, but those gains are recent. If you look at the past decade, works by Black artists are just 2.3% of all acquisitions at dozens of prominent museums around the country. That's according to recent data crunching by ArtNet News and a podcast called In Other Words. We're going to talk about this now with Naomi Beckwith. She's a curator at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Chicago. Hi there.
Hi. How are you, Madeline?
I'm fine. So does that number, 2.3%, surprise you?
It did, to be honest, but I think I've been lucky in my career in that I have worked with and at museums that have been a bit more intentional about including African-American artists in their collection. But if I were to think about the breadth of museums around the country, then maybe it isn't so surprising.
And so you're saying that a museum needs to be intentional in how it curates and how it collects. Can you flesh that out a little bit?
Every museum has a focus. Oftentimes those focus or foci are dependent upon who's working there. And as we've also seen from statistics, many museums don't have curators of color working there. It's imperative that institutions look at their own blind spots. You really have to pay attention to the programming you create, the artists you show, and of course the work you collect into the institutional permanent collection.
I wonder if there's kind of a vicious circle about it, because museums want to create shows that'll be popular. And if they put on artists who are popular and well-known, people will come to the shows and they'll make money. And so that sort of reinforces showing artists that are already in the public eye. And those artists are, by and large, white.
That is true. There is a kind of economic reality to what will sell to an audience. But I think there's two things to remember. There have been plenty of exhibitions that have shown well and sold well in terms of tickets that have represented artists of color and international artists. You started the program speaking about Carrie James Marshall. That was a blockbuster show for us at the Museum of Contemporary Art, and also a blockbuster when it went to the Metropolitan Museum in New York, as well as the Museum of Contemporary Art in LA. The second thing to really remember is the art on view doesn't necessarily have to be the art that you collect. The works that go into a museum collection will be the things written about, the things taken care of, the things that people come to research, and the things that go on view every once in a while, either in that museum or maybe it's going to be lent to another museum. But a collection itself also tells the story of art history.
So talk about the curator part of this, because there are very few curators who are people of color. I believe a recent survey found that only 4% of museum curators in the United States are Black, 16% are people of color. So how is that going to be changed?
I do think museums can do a better job of making sure that they're bringing in people who can tell stories that are outside of the mainstream stories that museums often default back to. Can a museum self-evaluate and say, we've been telling the story of a specific kind of art, let's say sculpture, but we've only been telling that story from the perspective of North America or Western Europe? Can we ask ourselves what's been happening in Latin America, what's been happening in Africa, what's been happening with communities of color across the United States? You have to hire people, but you also have to be open to believing that those stories are just as valid as the ones that we've traditionally been telling in museums and in schools.
So we're talking about contemporary art, or a lot of this conversation is about that. Is it easier to try to crack this through contemporary art because maybe people are more open to alternative means of expression and use of materials?
It's easier for me for the very simple reason that the art is happening in real time, that you have access to the artist right there in front of you, and you can go into their studio and do research on the work that's being made today. And in the most exciting cases, at least for me as a curator, you can work with the artist to create work as well. These things are incredibly exciting.
Can you give me an example of how you've tried to push this idea, tried to get an exhibition of a particular artist up, and the difficulties you may have encountered or roadblocks?
You don't want to call anyone out and give too many details. And so maybe I'll speak more generally, because I also have to say I've been fairly fortunate. But I do know of stories, anecdotes, and have seen situations where there are multiple roadblocks. One of them has been, is this artist important? Is this work of quality? These are questions often posed to artists of color. And to be frank, they're usually coded terms. Quality is usually a term levied against artists when it doesn't look as it should in terms of, let's say, the art history we're used to. The second question is, who's going to support it? Can an institution raise money to show this work or collect this work? Another factor essentially is, can we talk about this with any sort of authority? What if we don't have a team that includes someone of color? And that means maybe you need to bring in a guest curator. Maybe you need to bring in other people to subvent all of that expertise. And the last factor that I've seen that's become a roadblock is that sometimes institutions have such good intentions, they don't evaluate enough to realize that maybe they're not putting work to that intention. So one thing that I've done at the MCA is actually I've done a diagnostic of our collection to make sure that we're putting our money where our mouth is, so to speak, and making sure that the numbers of artists of color that we're pulling in are actually increasing when we say that it is.
Is it? After you've done your diagnostic?
The answer is yes, incrementally.
Yeah.
I did my diagnostic incrementally, and I have to say, even then, there are vast areas of improvement. But again, you have to make sure that facts are backing up the rhetoric that's there. And happily, my team has been receptive to that.
So where are you focusing on? What needs some help in your museum?
African-American artists may have been increasing, Latinx and Asian artists were declining. In that sense, I thought it was really important to say that you can't start sacrificing one for the other, and this shouldn't be a kind of competition, that you need to put pressures across the board on what it means to be American in some cases or what it means to be global in others. And we need to keep all those numbers afloat and not sort of start trading one for another. It's important to point out, too, that this is not a zero-sum game, that if, you know, artists of color increase, then all of a sudden white artists somehow are losing.
Still, there is a limited pool of money, and you have to choose what you're going to spend your money on.
Absolutely. And some people make hard decisions. For instance, the Baltimore Museum of Art actually deaccessioned some works and then used that money to acquire younger artists. Other institutions have just come up with very specific quotas. What I intend to do, and I think what I hope happens for many of the artists, especially as more artists and curators of color come into institutions, is that you advocate, advocate, advocate. And that advocacy are the things that's going to change collections.
Okay, so give us a couple of artists that you're really into, that you're advocating for.
Here's actually a great example that's happened and is still happening. I curated a show by an artist named Howardina Pindell that opened a little under a year ago in Chicago and is still traveling. And one thing that happened in advance of the show even being considered for the MCA is that we started collecting the work by this woman. Howardina is an amazing example for me of an artist who moves from incredibly modernist abstract work, really beautifully experimental abstract work, into the contemporary age. And you see the story she tells change. You see her materials change. She actually traces post-war American art for us. It's the history just really in this one body of work. And so I'm really excited to be able to tell that story, but also make sure the work comes into the collection even before the shows go on view. And then after the show goes on view, still collecting that body of work.
How did you find out about her?
Oh, she was someone who came to me when I was quite young as a student. She's famous for making a really important video called Free, White, and 21. And she did exactly the work in that video that I think I was trying to explain, maybe not as elegantly as she did, which is to say that even when people of color have sometimes been included in institutions as artists, as curators, as writers, their voice can still be ignored and subsumed. And she made this video as a warning to other feminists, actually, other white feminists, to say that to have me in the room isn't enough. I need to be empowered. And many feminist artists came across this work. Many people of color came across this work and found it a great inspiration. But what I realized is that if you weren't in art school, you probably didn't know her name. If you weren't a curator or a museum professional, you may not have known her name. So it was important to me to make a show that said, there is this important voice in the art world that did more than just make this incredible video. She has set out an entire trajectory for the history of painting for us.
That's Naomi Beckwith. She's a curator at the Museum of Contemporary Art, Chicago. And joining us now is Warren Olney, host of To The Point, the podcast. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. This is the first time of the 2019.
I know. It's exciting.
Yeah.
So what's on your show?
Well, one famous California politician, Jess Unruh, who was Speaker of the Assembly, once said that the only thing worse for Democrats than losing is winning. So we're going to take a look at what's happening in Washington. And can Nancy Pelosi, with her veteran leadership and the veteran leaders that she has with her, keep under control this new generation of Democrats? We're also going to take a look at the rest of the world. And without American leadership, will America's allies be able to get it together and maintain the world order?
Especially Angela Merkel, who's
That's right.
A lot of pressure.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Warren Olney, To The Point, the podcast. Get it wherever you get your podcasts.
And it'll be a great year.
Of course. Coming up, how L.A. became a football town, really a football town. a Sklar brother, a soul Sklar brother, is here next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
The sound of a cheering crowd tells it all.
Well, last year was a big sports year for us here in Los Angeles. The Dodgers made the World Series, LeBron joined the Lakers, and both of LA's football teams, the Rams and the Chargers, made the playoffs. Those playoffs begin this weekend, and Jason Sklar of the Sklar Brothers is here to tell us more. Hi.
Hi, how are you? I'm so glad I committed more to your show than Randy did.
I know.
Look at how much more I care.
You are the better Sklar.
Thank you.
I will say that on the air.
Well, okay. It's almost like you have like a Sklar Brothers of choices for football teams here in Los Angeles. NFL teams in the playoffs. Let's talk about this. A few years ago, we had no football in Los Angeles, no NFL football. And now here we go. We have two teams in the playoffs. The Rams have bettered their position better than last year by beating the 49ers at the end of the season. They've drawn a bye in the playoffs, which means they don't have to play in the first round. They play in the second round. January 12th is their first game. Very important for the Rams because their running back, Todd Gurley, super important player for the team, valuable player for the team. Some say he was out at the end of the season. They lost a couple games towards the end of the season. People are saying that might have been why. Well, he'll be healthy enough to come back and play. The Rams are saying he'll play. And this is big because last year the Rams lost in the first round of the playoffs to Atlanta, and they had a lot of promise last year. They surprised a lot of people, but then they were out of the playoffs in the first round, and everyone was saying, well, it's the same old Rams. Well, now the Rams have a good enough record. They're already in the second round of the playoffs. They can rest. They can be ready. The Chargers, on the other hand, this is a team. Chargers are my dark horse team
in
the playoffs.
So is the Chargers Randy and the Rams you, or vice versa?
I think I'm whoever wins. But the Chargers...
Who's more likely to win?
I think the Chargers, in a weird way, I feel like they have a better shot. Because think about the Chargers. They're playing in the StubHub Center, which is where the Galaxy play. That's not their home field. So essentially, they've been playing road games. They're a tough team, and they're super successful on the road. They're a team that I would not want to play, even if they have to go travel. And they do have to go travel and play the Baltimore Ravens in the first round, another team that's come on strong at the end of the season. But we've always said this. I think we've said this on this show. Philip Rivers, the quarterback for the Chargers, has 8 children, another one on the way. If he can get more wins than children in a season, it's going to be a good season for the Chargers. And then they did it. They're one of 5 12-win teams in the last 10 years to be in the wild card games.
They're playing the Ravens.
They're playing
on
the
Sunday.
On Sunday in Baltimore. But I think the Chargers have a good shot. Now, if the Chargers win there, then they go on to play the Patriots, which is, you know, Tom Brady.
Yeah,
he's still Tom Brady.
Are they still America's
They're still great.
Team?
Tom Brady is so great. It doesn't matter who. Belichick is a great coach. It doesn't matter who he's throwing to. He always seems to be able to make.
He's a machine.
Yeah, he makes these unknown guys successful, and he turns them into superstars. So they're always dangerous. But I think the Chargers, this might be their year. If they get through there, then they go play the Chiefs, possibly the Chiefs, a team that they met in probably one of the best regular season games this year, and they beat the Chiefs. So they can beat the Chiefs, and they can win on the road. They've proven that. And if they do that, then they're in the Super Bowl. Now, wouldn't it be crazy if the Rams met the Chargers in the Super Bowl? They come from the two different conferences, AFC and NFC. The Rams have a tougher path. A lot of people are saying that the Saints, the New Orleans Saints, are the pick to come out of the NFC. The Saints beat the Rams pretty badly, but the Rams have to take care of business right away. If Chicago wins in the first round against the Eagles, the Bears, the old Da Bears are back, and they're fantastic. They're strong on defense like they were in the 80s, which won them, of course, when they did the Super Bowl shuffle and they had William the Refrigerator Perry. That team won on defense. This team is doing the exact same thing, cut out of the same mold. And the Bears were a team that kept the Rams, a high-powered Rams offense, out of the end zone. They beat them 15-6 a couple weeks ago. So that'll be a tough matchup for the Rams in their first round that they're playing, which is the second round of the playoffs.
So it sounds like what you're saying is, although our teams are doing really well, they're still kind of underdogs.
A little bit. I mean, I think, you know, what you have right now is promise, and you have a lot of excitement here in Los Angeles. Again, remember, a few years ago, we had
no football
here. And now we have two teams that could potentially make it to the Super Bowl, but it's exciting that they're both in the playoffs, and they have a lot of, you know, they have core things in place on both teams that are exciting moving forward, too.
Okay, so let's talk about college football, too, because that's also happening, and it's the same old,
right?
The Clemson Tigers and the Alabama Crimson Tide
are playing in the national championship game on Monday night, this Monday night coming up. This is the fourth time, 4 years
wow.
in a row they've met? Because college football is predicated on recruiting, and these two schools recruit better than anyone else. They get the number one, number two, number three recruiting classes in the country, and it's all about the talent that you can amass.
And they have the money to recruit the top players.
I mean,
not that you're supposed to be.
Not just, but there are tales of bag men dropping off bags of poker chips on recruits' porches anonymously, and there's a lot of that talk down there. It's also a very regional game. You know, both those teams are down in the south, the southeast of this country, and a lot of people say the talent level and the high school football in that part of this country is just better. Mm. The players are quicker. The talent is higher. And if you're recruiting from that area, if that's your quote-unquote backyard, then you're going to get the best players. And Alabama has one of the best coaches of all time, Nick Saban, who's cementing himself as, you know, even more significant than the great Bear Bryant, who coached Alabama in the 60s and 70s. Nick Saban has been unbelievable, and a lot of people are saying Alabama is the favorite in this game, but don't sleep on Clemson. They have a freshman quarterback, Trevor Lawrence, who is unbelievable, who came in. You know, they had a quarterback last year who led them to the playoffs, and then they jettisoned that guy, and they stuck with a freshman, which is a bold move. That's why these two teams, I think, also are in the finals, because these two coaches understand that while they can be set in their ways, while they are gods in their own communities, they are adapting to the way college football is changing. And they're also saying, look, I'm going to go with this young quarterback, even though Alabama did the exact same thing. They had an older quarterback, and they jettisoned him in the national championship game last year, and it allowed them to beat Georgia. Here's the interesting thing, though. Four times these teams have met in the last 4 years, three times in the national championship game. The ticket value this year, the fans are saying it's boring. Ticket value is $2,000 less than it was last year when Alabama played Georgia in the finals. So last year, tickets were going—
Because people are just sick of seeing these two teams.
We've seen this.
Yeah,
that makes sense. We've seen this movie before. This is a sequel to a movie that we've already seen.
So let's just stay home and watch Netflix.
Let's watch Netflix and chill. But I actually think the crazy thing is these are the two best teams in college football. It's them. They are head and shoulders above the rest. I'm actually excited to watch the game, even though I'm sad to say that if I look forward to next year, 2020, I think these two teams might be in the finals again. And that's a bad place to be in sports when you can predict that with that much certainty the future.
Okay. Well, it's good to be able to predict something. In the
future, it is.
Because everything is so uncertain these days.
Well, it's an exciting time. I can predict that it's a new year, new page, and this is an exciting time for sports with the NFL and college
football. You
can't
even predict if your brother will be here with you.
I can't trust him.
I know.
I cannot
trust
him.
Jason Sklar of the Sklar Brothers. Check out their sports podcast. It's called View from the Cheap Seats. Thanks, Jason.
Thank you.
And joining us now, Christian Bordahl with some listener feedback.
Yes, but
hi
before we get to that, very quickly, I just want to mention that, you know, the real football you didn't get to talk about, which is
the football you
the
play
football
with
in
feet.
Europe. Exactly. There's a great American football player that just got signed for $73 million, Christian Pulisic, for Chelsea. So he's going to be playing in the Premier League.
Okay.
Anyway,
moving
more seriously,
on.
Yes. Anna Scott had a great story earlier in the show about Angelinos losing patience with the issue of homelessness and in some cases losing their empathy for people in that position. So I asked listeners about it, what their feelings are. Susan Arick says, it's not easy to maintain a compassionate attitude sometimes, both because I work so hard doing work I don't like to maintain a roof over my head, and also because I fear that if I lose that job, or if my rent goes up, I could be one of them.
Hmm.
Heather says she lived in beautiful Wilshire Vista 5 years. Locals complained about RV dwellers on Venice Boulevard. Overnight, parking signs changed and RV and car dwellers moved into the neighborhood, sleeping under my window and trashed the streets. It got too dangerous to come home at night from work. I had compassion for the neighbors sleeping in their cars. They had kids. As much as I hated the noise, garbage, and feces on the ground and smoke outside my apartment, I never called the cops because it's not for me to make their lives more complicated. I just moved. And more people are talking about that
so
as well.
Illustrating exactly what the story was about, which
exactly.
is impatience with what's happening on our streets. Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you, Christian Bordahl. Thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.